This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Charles Moore and John Humphreys.
Thank you. Gosh, thank you very much indeed. When this was set up, we sort of wondered who should, as it were, lead the conversation or who should interview him. And we decided it was it's a conversation and not an interview. And I'm rather relieved about that because I was on this very stage 2 weeks ago and I was being interviewed about my book by my old friend. At least I thought he was my old friend, Justin Webb. Yes, quite. And we have known each other for the best part of 30 years. And we had a tacit agreement that Justin would give me a nice, gentle, possibly slightly laudatory question to kick it off with, nice, something like that. Instead of which, he said, "So you've finished 33 years. Are you going to keep being a miserable old bastard?" Or words to that effect. And from then on, it went downhill, and I staggered off the stage, bleeding from every... So it's not going to be like that, is it, Charles?
Thank you, John. No, it's not.
No, I was asking you, not telling you. It might be from my side. But, fewer reasons for us to have that sort of conversation anyway, because Charles, as you... Well, why do I need to tell you this? I don't. He has written the definitive biography of a certain Margaret Thatcher, the last volume, of course, just published. And I think it's fair to say, Charles, that everybody believes it's brilliant. I have not read, and God knows I looked for them, a single critical word. It has had the most extraordinary reception. So congratulations on that. And what... And the third, of course, writing a trilogy... How do you do it? I mean, do you sit there all those years ago and think, I've now got to do, how many words altogether? Half a million? No, more.
No, more. More much, about, much, a mi- much, about a million.
A million words?
Yeah.
And doesn't it overwhelm you?
Yes, but only if you think about it that way. So the thing to do is to think about, like climbing a mountain by stages. Mm. And, you know, you go from base camp and then you go, and so on. And
then start running out of oxygen.
Well, that is, yes, there's a lot of altitude sickness here. Yeah. But I think the way you... Sometimes people say you should research everything and then write it all. Hmm. That's actually impossible, certainly on a thing of this scale, because by the time you get to write it, you will have forgotten a great deal of it. It's just unmanageable. But I think there's another reason why you shouldn't do it that way, which is that writing is a constant inquiry, and you only work out what you need to know by the act of writing. And so I find it much better to write a bit and then go away, work on the next bit, write some more, and then revise in the light of the further work you've done and so on.
Because you'd have had to interview... an awful lot of people before you wrote anything, because apart from anything else, they might well have been dead by the time you got around to...
Yes, I was sometimes in a race with The Undertaker. And in fact, I did used to notice if a certain person I was seeking was not looking very well and so on.
And some of the word going around, Charles Moore's going to interview me, must be dying soon.
They did, some of them did say that, yes. But what you often realise in the middle, I used to think, when I was at university, I used to think these wonderful dons who never wrote a book but knew everything about a subject were great, and why write a book if you knew it all sort of thing, and they were devoted to their researches. But I now think they were copping out slightly, because I think that I find at least that the only way you can actually truly decide what you think about something is to write it. Because it's only then that you'll really determinedly ask yourself the right questions.
Ah.
And that's why sometimes I'd have to interview someone else who I hadn't thought of until... So I might be in the middle of something and I'd think, I know who would know about this, John Humphreys, and I haven't asked him, or whatever, and get in touch with them. And often that's the best answers when, even though it's a historical inquiry, you ring them up and say, I need to know by tomorrow. And they start to sort of focus, almost as if it's a news story rather than...
How interesting. And did you find you changing your opinion of her as the writing went on? At the most basic level, did you like her when you started, and did you still like her when you finished?
I always think that the word like is a bit inadequate.
I knew you'd say that.
because
I fought it as I said it.
Because it's quite a weak word, and the thing is, Mrs. Thatcher was in some ways, I would say, dislikable, though I didn't personally feel that very strongly. I never had trouble. But, you know, she could be extremely harsh in argument. She could be terrifying. She could occasionally... I usually thought she was very good company, but occasionally she could be boring because she'd keep on and on at the point and say it again and again.
Was she a bully?
Yes, but not... Only to people who are more or less her equals.
Ah.
Which I think is much more attractive.
Like cabinet ministers, for instance.
Yes, so cabinet ministers, yes. She was not at all a bully to secretaries, drivers, policemen, all those people. They all loved her who worked for her. They really thought she was terrific, and she was very considerate. But to Geoffrey Howe or whatever, she was pretty unpleasant.
Yes, we got a... That's possibly an understatement, isn't it? Yes.
Or Helmut Kohl and so on.
Oh, yes. The famous dinner that they had, and she chased a bit of ghastly gristle around her plate or something.
She hated... He thought that he could persuade her that he what a true European he was if she came to see his home territory in Germany. But it was an absolute disaster because, first of all, she didn't really want him to... She didn't admire people for being... true Europeans. She preferred them to be true French or true whatever. Secondly, he was in fact very Germanic, which she didn't like because she was anti-German. So he was, you know, big and blobby, and he liked those funny bits of pig that they tend to eat. Which she really hated, pigs, trotters, and...
And
so it was an absolute cultural clash disaster. This were very well-meant...
Yes.
Visit. And she plonked herself down in the plane afterwards, and the whole plan had been that she would say, gosh, he's a good European, but she plonked herself down in the plane and said, oh, Charles, he's so German. So the whole thing had, was worse than useless.
A naive question, but how much do politicians... likes or dislikes of each other, how big a part, personal likes, dislikes, how big a part do they play in the grand scheme of things, those likes and dislikes?
Well, of course, this great sweep of history is much, much bigger even than the most famous personalities, but it does matter to them, and therefore it has these personal relations, and therefore it does have consequences, particularly with Mrs. Thatcher, because she was a global figure. I mean, she really was a global figure, and also because she had very, very visceral reactions. Though in many ways she was a very rational person, she was also... very visceral, and she would, and being the only woman among men, she had almost sexual reactions to different men. I don't mean any impropriety, but I mean she had tremendous engagement with the ones that she admired and liked the demeanor of, and she was very keen on what she called their bearing, and a visceral dislike of some who she thought were indecisive or mumbling or conceited or blobby or... And so she loved Reagan, she loved Gorbachev, she was sort of fooled by Mitterrand's charm, but she didn't like Kohl, she didn't like Geoffrey Howe, and so on. Mm. And the whole world really divided in her mind as to those sort of interactions. So actually it made a big difference, and luckily Reagan and Gorbachev were the two most important people in the world, so
it helped,
that was
it?
Helpful,
Yes, I remember being in Moscow when she made that famous visit of hers.
Yes, very successful,
Very successful.
Yeah.
And I was due to interview at the end of the day, and so was Charles Wheeler. I was going to do it for the Today programme. She was going to, in the embassy, in the British embassy in Moscow.
Yeah.
And she arrived after quite a long wait, and she'd had a hell of a day when you think about the first day. She got up early, she had those extraordinary scenes in the streets of Moscow where she was being hailed as a great hero. I mean, a conservative British Prime Minister being cheered to the echo. Anyway, she walked into the room where we were all waiting for her, and Charles, who was, I think I could safely, he's dead anyway, but I think I could safely say that he was a ladies' man. And
Charles who?
Charles Wheeler.
Oh, Charles Wheeler, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. It's as well we cleared that up, isn't it, really?
I was just toying with what the libel laws, how they operate.
Let me repeat, Charles Wheeler.
Yes.
But she walked into the room and Charles advanced on her, and you could almost see the electricity sparking between them. Quite extraordinary.
Yes. I think she used flirtation brilliantly because she was a very proper person, so it wasn't dangerous. Right. But it was a connection.
You sure about that, Charles?
Yes. I am. I think I am sure about that. Absolutely. And so, this energy was very, very apparent with her and Gorbachev, for example. Mm. And it sort of transformed things. And when you see, there's a picture in my book where you see them, they're meeting at Bryce Norton, and they can hardly wait to talk to one another. You can sort of see them rushing, and they're both talking at the same time.
Interesting, yeah.
It really was, because it had a dynamic effect.
And how about the Reagan relationship? Because obviously Gorbachev, very, very clever man. Reagan, not a very, very clever man. How did she...
Well, Reagan's not an intellectual man, but she...
Great, instinctive.
Yes, and brilliant politician. I mean, a sort of tremendous understanding of, and communicator. But the thing was, their friendship was forged in adversity. That's the key to it.
Yes.
Because they were both in opposition. He had no position at all in the mid-70s when they first met. Yeah. And they agreed on two big things: liberalizing the economy of the Western world and beating Soviet communism. And both of those things were unfashionable at that time. Mm. So when they both came in she 18 months before him, this was a tremendous bond. But again, it was a flirtation, because she thought of him as the sort of glamorous actor and the quintessence of America in some way, and he thought of her as the lovely English lady, quintessence of Britain in a way. And so it was quite a screen romance.
Could she pull it off in today's climate?
Do you mean with President Trump?
I mean, I positively wasn't thinking of President Trump, but since you raised the question, yes, what about her and President Trump?
Well, President Trump was, before he was president, of course, a great admirer of hers, and he tweeted, actually, because he was already tweeting when he was just a private citizen. It was you may remember that the only thing was a slight blot on her funeral, apart from the stuff beforehand about how it might be rather tense, but it wasn't, in fact. Mm. Was that the Americans under President Obama sent rather low-grade representation to the funeral, which caused offence, because, you know, she'd actually preached the oration, the first foreigner ever to preach the oration at the funeral of Ronald Reagan. And she preached it at great personal cost, because she was losing her mind, and so she had filmed it all in advance in London, and it was projected on the screens in the National Cathedral, but she still insisted on coming. So everyone was very moved by her appearance there and her readiness to come. And so she watched herself on the screen in the National Cathedral. And then she flew on Air Force One right across the United States to Santa Barbara for the interment. So she was everyone was very touched by this and her commitment to it. And so it was felt rather bad that not even the US ambassador in London came to the funeral. Mm. And it was felt to be... And it was felt by many Americans, including President Bush and Miss Senior and Mrs. Reagan, as a rude. Trump, as a private citizen, tweeted against it, and he said something like, you know, sad exclamation mark as always, and he said if it had been the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohammed Morsi, they would have all been crawling at his feet or something like that. So he was stirring it. But
in the broader sense of it, how would she? Could she, have survived in the present climate and thrived?
Well, I never like to do the would she, because...
No, I know.
I just don't know. But what I think is that people, successful politicians, capture the idiom of their age. Mm. And obviously the idiom of our age is very different.
But they've got to be flexible.
But what she was, yes, and what she was very... In some ways she was arrogant about her views and things, but she was incredibly professional. So she would, And she had to work it out very carefully because of being the only woman. So she had to think about everything in a way that a man wouldn't. How to train and lower her voice, how to do her hair, how to do her makeup, what to wear. Much bigger issue for a woman than a man, what to wear. And she was quite humble about all that. She would take endless advice about how to...
Gordon Rees, was it?
Gordon Rees got... He bumped into Laurence Olivier on a train and said, we've got this problem about her voice. And Olivier said, you can have the National Theatre's voice coach. And that helped her lower her voice. And she would always take advice about that, where she might be less ready to take it on what you might call bigger subjects. So, for example, you know, she had all her teeth redone and absolutely everything that was necessary, really. And so one imagines that in a different milieu, she would understand how to tweet, and find the way through that. But the style's just so different, it's actually quite hard to imagine.
Yeah, but she would still be, whatever she was doing, she would be a divisive figure, presumably. We talk about divisive politicians now as though they're something new.
Yes. Whenever I'm interviewed, and particularly when it's on the BBC, the first thing they always say is she was a divisive figure. And she certainly was in a way. I think that's true. But I think I'd make two points about that. One is that the key first thing to think about her was that she was a successful figure. I don't mean by that she was right, of course. I mean, that's a different matter. But in all the normal terms of success, longevity, election victories, fame, changing things, bringing in reforms, all those indices, she was the most successful British Prime Minister since the war. I think that's unarguable. Never lost an election and so on.
Yes, couldn't argue with that. Yeah.
And also, though she was divisive, I mean, classically on Europe, for example, there are important subjects where she solved things. So the classic one would be the trade union laws.
Yeah.
Terrific battles, but 1979, when she comes in, 29.2 million working days lost to strikes. 1990, when she goes out, fewer than 2 million working days lost to strikes. So actually, in the industrial scene, the workplace, very little division once she's finished. You know, and it's never recurred. We only had 235,000 working days lost to strikes last year.
On the other hand, poll tax, when she simply didn't listen. At least that's the impression one has from your book, that she was simply not listening.
In a way, they were all in it together. They all signed in blood, except for Nigel Lawson. So she wasn't alone on that one. But you're right that she got stuck on it, and she couldn't see a way out. And so it just got worse and worse, and they threw some money at it. But
basically, the Scotland decision was simply bizarre.
Well, the bit that people forget is that the rates were so unpopular, the previous local taxes, that the Scots actually asked to go first. You know, nowadays it was always said we were made a guinea pig, but the Scots actually asked to go first because they were having a rating revaluation. So their rates were absolutely going to shoot up. And so there was a great rush to get in the poll tax in Scotland so they wouldn't get the rate revaluation. I mean, it was a disaster. But it's interesting how people thought about these things at the time.
And was her a fall when it came? Was it inevitable? Did it have to... I mean, of course, all falls are inevitable for one reason or another. But
strictly speaking, it was... I mean, there's a trajectory, and she was on a downward trajectory.
Indeed.
But I think it was not inevitable. After all, she only lost the first ballot. She didn't. She won the first ballot, but she failed to reach the margin that would have made her win on the first ballot. And so it seems obvious that with better organisation, she could have won that. Whether that would have been a good thing for her or for anyone is another matter, because obviously she would have been badly wounded. But probably it might have been a bit more dignified. She could have left within the next 6 months in a quieter way. And I certainly think it's true that the way she left caused bad blood that continues to this day.
Oh, really? How was that manifested?
Well, people thought it was unjust, and it was all circulating, particularly around the European question, so that stays live right up till now. And it meant that she couldn't, as it were, lie quiet in her grave, I mean, her political grave. And she behaved very unfairly to John Major.
Oh, yes.
But equally, it was sort of understandable given how traumatic it was. When she left office, I met her and she was writing her memoirs, and I said, "What are you going to call them?" And she said, "Undefeated." And the reason for this, of course, was that it was literally true. Because, first of all, she'd won all the general elections that she contested as leader, and she got more votes in the leadership election, which caused her to leave, than anyone else did, more than Heseltine and more than Major. So, and yet she had to go. So you can see why she's sort of saying to herself, "What have I done wrong for you lot? You know, ever since you chose me, I've won everything I'm supposed to win. Why are you doing this to me?"
And you paint the most dramatic and tragic, in a sense, picture of her after she left Number 10 and went to her house, her home, although Number 10 had been her home for so long, hadn't it, and simply didn't know how to do anything, like turn on the electricity or whatever it happened to be. And she had no money, money in the bank.
She had no money in the bank, and Dennis was reluctant to come across with it.
Was he a cheapskate?
Dennis was certainly careful with money. One of his favourite expressions when anything was too expensive, he'd say, "They charge like the Light Brigade."
You could see him saying that, can't you?
Yes. He was good on those sort of naffy canteen phrases of the 1940s. Very good. If his steak was not well done enough, he'd say to the waiter, "Take it away and bring it back when it stopped mooing."
I had an editor who used to say, "Take it away, do all that, grill it and grill it again." And then he was Welsh, and he said, and "bring it back to me when the chef is in tears."
Oh, yes, you mentioned him in your book. Yes. But she was absolutely disoriented. When you're Prime Minister in Britain, you don't live in luxury at all, but you do have everything done for you.
Quite.
In the sense of brilliant Downing Street switchboard, gets you anybody in the world. In those days, no mobiles. So when she left office, she didn't know what an answering machine was. She didn't know how to use a mobile phone. She didn't know how to use a computer. She probably hadn't direct dialed anybody for 11 years because it'd always be got for her.
Yeah.
And she was one thing when Charles Pole, her most devoted private secretary, she's now left office, and she rings him up one Saturday morning and says, "I've got a leak in the pipes. What shall I do?" And he says, "Well, you better get a plumber." And she said, "I don't know how to do that." And he said, "Look in the yellow..."
Mind you, she's not alone in that, I can tell you. It's somebody who lives in London.
Yes. And it was before the Polish ones. And she said... And she said, "How do I do that?" And he said, "Well, look in the yellow pages." He said, "Well, I don't know how to do that." And so he said, "All right." So he came round and did it. So we had, you know, Sir Charles Pole, great, was there. He was fiddling around with the pipes.
But you're right about that. She phoned me once one morning.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, it was 6:40, and I was sitting in the TV studio, not fairly quite new there. Just done an interview with a Russian, Gennady Gerasimov, who was a big figure in the in Moscow in those days, and she was due to make a visit to Moscow. And I'd interviewed him about whatever it was, and he said whatever it was. Five, 10 minutes later, my producer came into my ear and said, "We've got the Prime Minister on the phone." And I thought, "No, you don't. You're winding me up." And I made the appropriate, And there, literally a second or two later, was "Mr. Humphreys, good morning to you." And she picked up the phone in the kitchen of Number 10, heard something on it. Can you imagine that happening?
Yes.
And I mean, Alistair Campbell allowing that to happen?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, he'd have removed the heads from the body.
Well, she did do it without consulting anybody.
Totally.
Which is actually unusual because she was usually careful. But
totally. I met Bernard Ingham quite a few months later. Yeah. And we talked about it, and he said the first he knew about it was when Bernard Ingham, her press secretary, and the first he knew about it was driving down the motorway on his way into work at 27 in the morning, and it was her voice on the phone. And he said, "I heard it. I nearly drove off the fucking road."
Yes, well, the reason was, actually, I think sorry to correct you, but I think the reason was not that she was going to Russia, but that Gorbachev was coming here.
Gorbachev was coming
and
here.
And then the terrible Armenian earthquake took place. That's and right. What concerned her was two things. One, that why she rang you up was she was very keen to get across her sympathy and help for the Armenian earthquake, that Britain was going to do something straight away, and also very keen to make it clear why Gorbachev wasn't coming, because she didn't want it to be thought that he was somehow being unfriendly to Britain. And so she thought, she always listened, as you know, religiously to the paper. She got up in time for Farming Today and started working, and then onto the Today programme.
And it was said, is this true, that if a junior minister performed really badly on the Today programme, he was toast?
I think it didn't help, yeah. And when she left office, her idea of the BBC was largely the Today programme. And though she actually loved the programme, she, of course, had a very, very unfavourable view of the BBC and its sort of spin on everything. And so when she left, her private secretary and others in the office gave her a present, which was a shortwave radio, and as Andrew Turnbull, the private secretary, put it when he gave it to her, so that wherever you go in the world, you can be annoyed by the BBC.
Yes. Did she really not approve of the BBC?
She didn't. Actually, it's not quite... She was very anti the BBC in its current incarnation, but she did, in fact, believe in the BBC in Reithian terms. Mm. She wanted to go back to what she saw as sort of core Reithian values. She did not really want to privatise it, though she wanted to break up its monopoly. She wanted other... She, of course, helped Rupert Murdoch with Sky and all that sort of thing. But she wanted the BBC to be a core thing of which she saw as information and high culture and education. And she didn't have any time for the rest of it. And, of course, she also thought it was very biased. And Dennis absolutely hated her, hated it and was always stirring her up on the subject. But she... You will remember that when she tried to attack the BBC, what she tried to do was get different people in as the chairman. So Dukey Hussey, she put
indeed.
In, rather than trying to turn the whole world of the BBC upside down.
But she seemed to regard us on the Today programme anyway. We might well have been the enemy, I don't know, you can tell me that. But she recognised the importance of the Today programme and was always, at least it felt from my end of it, pretty happy to come on, pretty relaxed about appearing, unlike present company, or rather present prime ministers.
Yes, Mrs. Thatcher almost never refused the opportunity to go on and have an argument.
Yes.
And with you, John, that would have been guaranteed. So,
but it wasn't just the argument. It was that she was so unpredictable because she wasn't schooled in the media studies, media, so-called media training. I don't believe there's any such thing, personally. But anyway, so-called media training. She wasn't schooled in that. And the danger of that, or the joy of that, simultaneously, was that you didn't know what she was going to say. I mean, you hadn't... And now, ever since all of this stuff began, you've got a pretty clear idea from the start of the interview with the politician what they go... You know, because they've said it 100 times before, and you know it's going to be churned out the same way, and you know when they're going to refuse, and all that. But with her... I remember the very first interview I did with her on the Today programme as Prime Minister in 1987, during the 87 election campaign. And I was a brand new boy on the Today programme. I knew absolutely nothing about interviewing, let alone interviewing the most powerful person, the powerful woman, certainly, in the world. And I was terrified. How was I going to do something that might surprise people and make my mark on the programme that I had just started? And I figured that the way to do it might be to approach her from a slightly different angle. We all knew, everybody knew, they were fed up with talking about it, that the country was going to the dogs, unemployment, and so on. And I planned my strategy along these lines. I thought if I asked her about her religion, and she was religious, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
If I were to ask her what is the essence of Christianity, I persuaded myself, always a mistake, I persuaded myself that she would say something like love or charity or whatever. Normal people would, wouldn't they? And I would then be able to slap my hand on the table and say, you talk about love, you talk about charity. And look at the country. Children going to school without any shoes on their feet. The nation in a desperate state. And she would be so shocked by my onslaught that she would resign on air and I would become... I would become the hero of a grateful nation. So I asked the question, what is the essence of Christianity? Answered in one word, choice. Oh, shit. I mean, with time... You know, you can think about the response, but I had neither the time nor the brain nor the whatever to cope with it. It was a devastating. I was scared of her ever since then. I mean, I never recovered from it. But she was extraordinary.
Her thinking on that was that this is the predicament, if you like, of man because of the fall. So Adam and Eve made the choice and have the knowledge of good and evil, and therefore it's a responsibility of each man and woman to make a choice, either the right one or the wrong one. So that would be the religious basis. Did you find that she... as you saw more of her, what do you think were the... seen from a professional point of view, were the chinks in her armour when you were interviewing her? What was the way to get... to get something.
Well, I never did discover that, and I'm not sure any of us ever did, except that you'll remember the famous Dimbleby interview,
yes,
in which she talked about mewling and puking wealth. You're going to correct me now, because it wasn't quite that, was it?
But drooling.
Drooling. Yeah. Well, not much better. Yeah. Drooling and welfare seekers, in answer to Dimbleby's question. And that was her weakness, wasn't it? That she was prepared to say what she believed didn't matter what anybody else thought. Now, you can tell me, and this I've always wanted to know, is when she did that, did she immediately realise, one got the sense after that particular interview, during that particular interview, she did realise what she'd done and thought, oh, my God, I've got to get out of this hole. But was that the case?
She did in that particular case, and she apologised on air.
Yes.
For that one, which I think was unique, actually.
Absolutely.
She thought interviews were a form of attack, that she was being attacked, and as she used to say, this animal, when it's attacked, defends itself. Did she say that about herself? But also
Did she use that phrase?
Yes. But she wanted to attack anyway because she wanted to preach the gospel. She saw it as... She welcomed interviews on the whole because her background as the son of a daughter of a Methodist lay preacher, as well as a grocer, was to preach the gospel. So she wanted to preach her political gospel in season and out of season, as they say. And so you always hear that. If you listen to a Thatcher interview, it's always, always trying to put the message across in the most clear and firm way. And there's another reason why she thought that way, which is that she thought very much about being the only woman. She thought that any sort of admission, any recoil... would just be grabbed by men and used to exclude her and defeat her. She said there's no second chance for a woman. She believes strongly that the male club would defend its members, and so they could mess up, but they'd give one another job. Whereas if she had to be on top of everything, otherwise she'd be out.
Was she right?
Yes, I think fundamentally she was right, and that's partly why she did fall in the end when the club finally got together against her, having tried on two or three previous occasions. And this time they did. And so it's essential for her to keep winning all the time in argument, keep on top of the argument, make the new bit of the argument, and she used you guys to do that. Mm. And on the whole, success... I mean, sometimes the interviews with her are terribly frustrating to watch because she keeps saying the same thing, but it's not because...
Hardly alone in that.
Yeah, but it's not because she's trying to conceal so much, which is what you tend to get now. It's not damage limitation, it's more hot gospeling.
Hot gospeling, yes. Mm. That was what made her such fun to interview.
It was fun in a way, yes. I found it very frustrating when I was interviewing her for historical purposes because she thought, in her mind, she couldn't get the model of the combative public interview. So, you know, I was trying to ask her straight historical questions and she'd behave as if I was you, sort of thing. And she'd say, you know, how dare you say that? Or, you know, she'd sort of... and I was just quietly trying to get hold of... Or she accused me of being a socialist. All those sort of games that people play in those companies. Most frustrating and odd. But you think, do you, John, that you write very interestingly about interviewing different people in your book, which as you can see by all these post-it notes I've read with great
pleasure. All the bits that he disapproved of.
Read with great pleasure. And it has some wonderful set pieces. It looks to me basically, as you complain quite a lot about the way interviewing has gone, both in terms of how the people interviewed behave, the politicians behave, and you also ask yourself some questions about whether you and others take the right tone and form in the way you ask the questions. But on that first point about how they behave, how has it changed? I mean, the two masters of the interview that you've most dealt with, I suppose, masters in utterly different ways, are Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. Tell us about that comparison.
Well, yes, masters of the interview in very different... The difference is that Tony Blair had a puppet master. And she didn't, did she? At least, I assume she didn't.
No, I mean,
Ingham didn't perform that.
He was very tough with her, but he wasn't political.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Whereas Campbell was both very tough and very political. Mm. And you could see the Campbell bit of Blair's brain whirring while you were interviewing him. I don't know that he had any particular weaknesses, except that he was unconscious of when he was... Use the word preaching for Margaret. Well, Blair did that as well. I remember an interview you may think this is slightly tangential, but I did lots of interviews, obviously, after Iraq, a particularly long one for us on the Today programme, 35 minutes, longest we've ever done on the Today programme, after he'd announced his resignation. And I put the usual stuff to him that I'd over and over and over again, and in the end, I said to him, in despair, rather than the essence of, well, come on, look at how it has turned out. You got it horribly, horribly, horribly wrong. Didn't your words that? Mm. And he said, and it's an expression that stuck with me ever since, he said, I only know what I believe.
Yes.
And that seemed to me to be 180 degrees wrong, really, because if you're going to send men to war to die for the country, you have to base your belief on what you know. Yeah. On what you have been told by the people.
Only believe what you know rather than know what you
believe. And you believe what you know rather than know what you believe. And that was there was that aspect to. I mean, I believe that we will never know for sure, but I believe that he really did sit and pray with Bush in Texas on that. I mean, because that.
By the way, wouldn't have been a disgraceful thing to do. I mean,
they're both facing your decision on what God tells you to do.
Well, but every believer should pray about such matters. So if I mean, I don't know what happened, I've had no idea, but if President Bush had said, let's pray about this together, perfectly reasonable, as long as they didn't regard it as a sort of policy meeting.
but that is precisely the point, isn't it? Exactly. Exactly.
But wouldn't you agree about Blair that though people often called him a liar, and he was certainly brilliant at slipping round problems, that the message that he put across with great, great clarity about what he was true. That's to say, he genuinely was a non-sectarian centrist...
Absolutely.
..sort of modern person.
Completely, I believe that, I believe that now, yes.
And therefore... Also, and if you particularly compare him with Gordon Brown, when you listen to Blair, his words are incredibly clear. I mean, always in a broadcast, you know what he's saying. Whereas Gordon Brown, you absolutely couldn't work out what he was talking about and didn't really want to. In an odd way, I think Blair had a sort of meta-honesty, though he was extremely slippery on...
I'm sure that's right. Brown, as you say, quite the opposite. Brown had lots of terribly... more than irritating tics as well. He would, like they all do, he would come into the studio with a message that he wanted to deliver. I mean, of course, that's the whole point of a political interview from their perspective, of course. But with Brown, you could see him watching the clock as it ticked to whatever it was, 8:15, and the interview was meant to finish at 8:18 or whatever it was, and you could see them. And at a certain point in the interview, he would say, whatever the question was, if he felt he hadn't got his message across, he would say, I've got 3 points to make in answer to that question, and your heart would sink, because if somebody says, you've got to let him make the 3 points, even though you don't want him to make those 3 points because you want to get into the question you were really... And he did this over and again. Eventually, after one of these interminable interviews where we got absolutely nowhere, I said to him over a cup of coffee later, you're aware, are you, Gordon, that you're doing this 3 points thing? And he said, oh, I'm not sure I was aware of that. No, well, thanks for pointing it out. And I thought, progress. The next time I interviewed him, I asked him whatever the question was at exactly that point in the interview, because I could see his eyes going around a little bit, and I asked him what the question was. And he looked at me straight in the eye and said, I've got 5 points to make an answer to that. He did have a sense of humour.
Yes. And he's by no means a fool, because, of course, all these people like him are trying to get through the interview.
Absolutely not a fool, no.
And again, because I think he wasn't so keen on sharing his thought processes with Mrs. Thatcher. He was more trying just to get through it without being caught out.
Talking about getting through it, we are 45 minutes into our thing. I've been keeping a little eye on the clock, like Gordon Brown, and I think can we have the lights up so that we can see the lights of everybody's eyes? And if they wish to be seen, that is. The whites, did I say the lights of everybody's eyes? So anyway, and then, ladies and gentlemen, it is your turn to ask questions of us.
But we
must have the lights up, please, because we kind of want to see the faces. You don't need to sit in Stygian gloom.
Do you see there's a gentleman there next near the microphone?
There we are. Yeah. Well, let's give it to that gentleman, and then please let us have the lights on. Somebody switch the light on over there.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Lorne Smith. Charles, I think everybody in this room realises you're the foremost Conservative commentator in the country, and we all worship you.
Wow.
One of the things that is so incredible is your breadth of ability to talk about so many different subjects. But could I just be slightly critical of one thing, if I may? You're a great country sportsman, but may I suggest that you have no understanding of ball games? I hope you realise that. Yeah. A couple of times you've made comments over the years and you've got them absolutely wrong. I'm just interested to hear what your thoughts were about that.
It's true.
And that'll do.
And as you're my worshipper, you must take it from me that it's true.
You've no interest in ball games.
No. Not really. I'm not much of a spectator. I like playing tennis, and I used to like playing football, but I don't watch sport.
Quite. Very wise. Yeah. Very sound. But another question. If with the microphone, whoever's got a microphone, if you can hold up your hand. There we are. Question there. I can't see the person, but you can, so. Yes.
First of all, thank you very much for a really illuminating discussion. But I wondered, through your experiences of both of your careers and through the process of writing your books, just how cynical are you both about politics and the ability of political leaders, or do you have a sort of begrudging respect for them?
I'm not cynical. Skeptical, yes. Profoundly skeptical. Sometimes disbelieving. But not cynical. If only, and this is a pragmatic answer to a deeply important philosophical question, but if only because we need them. And once you become cynical about the process, you're effectively saying, well, let's look for another process. We've got to find another way of doing it, and I don't think there is another way of doing it. It isn't quite answering your question directly. I appreciate that. But there isn't another. We have a system that, by and large, works. We're going through a difficult period now, for obvious reasons, but nonetheless, it is more or less, and I know you will argue about, we will be arguing about this for the next God knows how many years, but nonetheless, is more or less democratic. I mean, people, yes, I know, but people, if MPs decide to do a thing of which we disapprove, yep, we can be deeply skeptical about it, even cynical, perhaps in your case, I don't know. But nonetheless, that person is an MP and that person has a right to that person's decision. And what we're seeing at the moment, we're not seeing tanks on the street, we're not seeing usurping of power. I happen to believe personally that the judges probably did get it wrong. Why they got it wrong, who knows? But it was a suspiciously unanimous vote, it seemed to me, and when I was... But... And there is no... I mean, Charles makes the point in his book that in Thatcher's day, I think I quote you more or less accurately, Charles, there were about nine people who could have become prime minister at that time. Who were good enough to. And now you might argue that if you look around the present bunch, you'd struggle to find one. but I'm not that pessimistic. I don't know, are you, Charles?
I'd just add to the point about not being cynical. If you are cynical about it, what you're also being is cynical about yourself in a way, because the whole point is that we've chosen these people. We don't have to choose these people, we can choose other people. I mean, obviously we don't have an absolutely free choice, but it seems to me rather weird that we think we can attack them without, and when we do that we sort of don't look in the mirror. But I do think actually there is a bit of a crisis here, which the Brexit thing has brought up. You use the word usurpation. And I do think that lots of people have thrown mud at one another about all sorts of things which aren't really usurpation. But I do think the key thing which has been underemphasized is the usurping behavior of Mr. Speaker. Because...
Yep.
Actually, that's the most important thing that's happened, because the usual sort of shenanigans in Parliament always happen when there are small majorities, and fair enough, you try to play the rules for your side. But he's done two things. One is that he's taken away the whole idea of his impartiality, which, of course, is appalling. And the other is that he's misunderstood the doctrine of the Crown in Parliament. And so he thinks that, which is the basis of our constitution, unlike most constitutions, we don't have this clear separation between the legislature and the government, because it all sort of takes place through that one institution. But we govern through Parliament. We're not governed by Parliament. And what Mr. Speaker has done is decided, by taking control of the government, what used to be government business, that the House of Commons is the government. So that it takes the decisions about what to do next in a negotiation or something. Now, this is actually madness, as a matter of fact. You can't have a legislative body negotiating at an international treaty. It just doesn't make any sense. But it also makes it impossible to govern, actually. And that's what we've got now, particularly as we also have, thanks to Oliver Letwin, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which he concocted with the coalition. So that the Parliament is saying, we're not letting you govern, and we're not letting you have an election. So we're all just sitting there. And it is the most extraordinary. We may get the result. We've asked if the result's going to come through to us so that we can all announce it. If you get it on your phone, shout out, please, because... They've lost the programme motion.
Oh, they did? Ah, ah. 30 votes up on the bill, 14
against on the programme. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, on we go, then.
On we go. Or not, as the case may be, yes. Yeah. Quite. Yes, I think there's a question back there, wasn't there? Yes. Right, straight in front of me. And then if we get another microphone somewhere else, and then we have no pause. Yeah, if there's somebody there, go. Yeah, but you, sir, at the back, yeah.
Roger Kendrick, now that the BBC has become a campaign organisation for the EU, Remain, and the metropolitan liberal elite... Do you think it's right that you have to pay a licence fee to own a television in this country?
Charles, well, shall you go first or shall I? Yes! yes to the second bit, no to the first. I've been critical in my book that the BBC's mindset over the years, over relatively recent years, over the last 20 years anyway, has been more or less lefty liberal, more or less. But I emphasize that is a mindset. It has never, I repeat, never influenced me in any way, and you may say for good or ill, up to you, but the job that I do, in the most simple terms, nobody has ever said to me, and I've been in doing the Today Program for 33 years, nobody has ever said to me, you should interview this person in this particular way, or go easy on this, or be tough on that, or do this, or that, or the other, let alone actually propose questions that I'm... or whatever. There is not that sort of direct interference. What there is, at least certainly never with me, never has been. If there were, I would have walked out of the BBC a very, very long time ago. What there is a mindset that, for my tastes, is a wee bit too soft liberal. And the examples of that are fairly obvious, I think, to many of you in this room. For instance, we appointed a little while ago an LGBT correspondent who soon after, well, you can have views as to whether we need one or not, soon after his appointment, he announced or did an interview in which he said that he regarded himself as a voice piece for the gay community. Now, I don't want correspondents on the BBC to be voice pieces for anything. If we have a health correspondent, I don't want him or her to be a voice piece for the National Health Service. I want them to report impartially, without bias, insofar as it's possible, and above all, as accurately as possible. But there is a sense in the BBC that the sort of vague guardian view of the world is rather a good one, is pretty much where we'd all quite like to be. And I would prefer a system where it's we know, where editors know, where their producers and their journalists stand, not because they want to be able to direct them in a particular way, but if on a newspaper, Charles, you can tell me, you've been an editor of a newspaper, I suspect that you knew what the politics more or less were of all the senior journalists who worked for you.
Funny enough, not actually, not necessarily. And sometimes it was quite surprising because the Telegraph, in its editorial line, was always pro-conservative. Quite often you'd find that one of your great specialists was a communist or whatever. And but the news was very... the rules were sort of observed about the neutrality in that. Quite carefully separated.
How did you monitor that?
You didn't really. You could just sort of see it. It's to do with professionalism, I think, as it is indeed in the BBC. I mean, there are lots of correspondents who, when I listen to them, I absolutely can't tell whether they have a political line. Mm. And then there are some which I jolly well can. Like, there's an absolutely disgraceful man called Roger Harabin, who does the environmental stuff, who just... it's just out-and-out propaganda. I mean, he's a very able broadcaster, but it's just out-and-out propaganda for quite an extreme... almost Extinction Rebellion type position.
He did a piece the other day attacking Extinction Rebellion for the way that they were protesting.
Mm. Sorry?
He did. He did a piece the other day attacking Extinction Rebellion for the way they were. You'd have to argue, wouldn't you, that his what he was reporting quite a few years ago has proved to be right. I mean, the science is not any longer, as far as global warming, you may disagree. My view is that science is no longer deniable.
First of all, no argument of this short, of no question of this sort should be above argument. So it's very important.
It depends whether the science is right or not.
All science is a form of knowledge. It's always an advancing form of knowledge.
Quite.
When people say the science is settled, that can't be true. It's not the way. But my point is not so much that. It's that under the umbrella of science, advances what are in fact a whole load of political, economic, and social theories about social control, political, taxation, government power, and so on, which is all sort of assumed that we have to do X and we have to do it in a particular time and we have to make laws about it without thinking about liberty or how it affects poorer people or and so on. So all I'm saying is that I feel what you hear on the BBC about this subject is a form of preaching, not a form of news reporting. And I think it's very marked on that subject.
So what would you have us do? Or rather, them do?
Well, I always think it's interesting to look at what the BBC asks tough questions about and what it doesn't. So, and that, I think, tells you a lot. So, for example, every day on the Today programme, there are lots of news stories when it says, a new report says, and what the new report usually says is that not enough money is being, that X service is being starved of resources, or that there are a lot of victims or something or other who need more government money. Fine, it was in principle very important stuff. But how many times does the BBC News lead on things like overspending or problems that people feel about rising taxes? The whole idea, the government is never scrutinised by the BBC about how it's using our money. It almost never happens. And instead of which it's framed as why can't there be more money for X and Y? That's true of about 90%.
You've obviously not heard a particular presenter, I won't mention his name, obviously, because modesty forbids me, but who frequently pointed out to ministers, whether they were Chancellor Exchequer or anybody else, that when they talked about government money, I always made the point that it isn't government money, it's people's money.
Well, indeed, and that was that's a famous Mrs. Thatcher point, but you're a good deed in a naughty...
I learned a lot from
you're them. A good deed in a naughty world, John. I mean, particularly naughty world. The question also was about the licence fee, and it does seem to me that I've thought this, and indeed I've been fined for not paying my licence fee in Hastings Magistrates Court because I took a case about it.
Famously.
It seems to me quite wrong that any media institution should be funded by compulsory payment. And when you tell it to foreigners, they can't believe that you have to do this, that you, when you buy a television, even if you don't watch a single minute of the BBC, you have to pay. The BBC earns more money every year from compulsory levy than the whole budget of the Foreign Office and the whole budget, or the whole budget of HM Treasury, about £4 billion a year.
Budget of HM Treasury?
No, the budget of the Treasury as a government department, not the British government. Even you guys at the BBC wouldn't have pulled that one off. But
then, on the other hand, I've never heard of the Treasury having to make television programmes. But anyway, perhaps they do, I don't know.
No, but if you think of what the power that gives you, it means that you have a unique position, and when people have unique positions, though some people in the BBC have very high standards, when they have unique positions, they abuse them.
Of course.
And on a massive scale, actually, and even in the most basic sense that these various scandals exposed about pay and things, it was abused in a very literal greedy sense that people were getting very overpaid, that sort of thing. But I'm not really talking about that. What I mean is that they think they're right, and therefore they think they can do what they want, and they therefore actually don't want to be responsive. How was it? You write brilliantly yourself in this book about how, I think you say, all the bosses, every man and woman of the BBC, couldn't understand how anybody could be so stupid as to put their cross in the leave box in the referendum.
That's a slightly different question, isn't it?
Well, no, it isn't.
Oh, it doesn't address the licence fee, does
it? No, it does, because if you've got guaranteed income, you can scorn your... the people who are paying it.
Except
they can't walk away from it. I don't pay the licence fee, I ultimately go to prison.
What I also said in that chapter, as I recall, is something I think even you agreed with, which was that we reported the referendum fairly and straight. That is the overwhelming opinion. Maybe not of this particular assembly who are here to applaud you, and that's fine. But
I think it's an interesting example because the BBC is much better. The BBC accord when it has very strict rules, which it does on some things, it obeys them. So in referendum,
well, that's quite important.
It is important, but I mean it's the least they can do.
It's very begrudging.
It's interesting on Brexit because when you have a referendum campaign or an election campaign, there are strict rules about time of balance.
Very strict.
The BBC obeys them. As soon as the referendum results came in and that went away, it immediately swung hugely towards Remain because that formal rule ended. And ever since then, they've been working very, very hard to for Remain.
I don't agree with that.
Always frame the... and again, I could tell by your tone of voice that you were not typical. And now you explain that in your book very well. But honestly, it's the case, and it's the case on so many subjects. And it seems to be an exploitation of privilege, and it's actually very divisive, because it means that, you know, the whole point of the BBC, you say this very well in your book, is credibility, is trust. And I'm afraid I absolutely do not trust it on some subjects.
So what would you do? In practical terms, which bits... Well, first of all, you get rid of the licence fee, yeah?
Yeah.
Totally. And how would the BBC
yes,
then...
Yes, I think... Well, I think first, I might do it in stages. I've thought... Because I'm interested to see what happens. Suppose you said, look, let's look at the important bits and let's get rid of the... Basically, the doctrine of the BBC is wider still and wider, like in Land of Hope and Glory.
But whenever with respect, you're not answering the question. What bits would you get rid of?
Well, I would reverse...
I mean, would you get rid of Strictly Come Dancing or Newsnight or...
I would reverse wider still and wider. So I would say you don't have to capture every bit of new media as it develops.
Right.
What you should concentrate on is what you can uniquely do, which is of serious value. And therefore, I would say, I invite you to follow those broad principles, and we're going to cut the licence fee in half.
You would cut the licence, so you cut the licence fee.
Let's say.
But would you do that? I mean, you do have to have a view on this if you're...
Well, I think it's an election, politically, I think it's great. You know, if people thought they'd be only going to pay £75 instead of £150, that would make them more likely to vote
and
for the party.
And then, therefore, you would sacrifice what? I mean, let's assume that you sacked half the bosses, and I wouldn't be totally averse to that myself. But having done that and it didn't achieve those savings, so you'd be... Look, Charles, you know perfectly well, you would be left having to cut an awful lot of programmes or get rid of a lot of foreign correspondents and
I think it would be very foolish for a government to say which programmes...
I'm asking you, not the government.
Or very foolish for me too, but I would say is I would say follow the principles. Go back to Reithian principles and say...
Inform, educate, entertain.
What really matters here and what doesn't, and what can other people do better or just as well? And then you'd suddenly find that it would concentrate minds. And also, you describe this so well in your book, this extraordinary number of sort of people call things like controllers in the BBC.
Yes. Would you stop being nice about my book?
who have all these endless meetings. I mean, you know, really, are they necessary?
I bet you had a few in the Telegraph as well.
Very few, actually. No, we really were very... Yeah, very...
But of course one agrees that. Well, no, we better not spend too much more time on this. You still haven't, if I may say so, answered the question. What would you actually... If Charles Moore were Director General and he'd been told that his budget had been cut by 50%, what would he cut? What would he chop from the BBC's output? Gary Lineker, yes! I'm on record in the book as saying that, but that's only 1.75. In fact, it's not even that any longer because he's taken a pay cut. I think it's a modest 1.7. No, I don't know how much it is. But anyway, go on. Just a quick one on that.
No, I don't think it is sensible to, because I don't think I'd have a good prescription necessarily.
That's the problem.
I would apply it. I would apply those general principles and invite the BBC to act upon them. And all I would say, if I were, as it were, dictator, is you're going to only get half the money. And then you'd see what they did. But by the way, I am entirely against the principle of the licence fee, so I will be happy to abolish it altogether. But I can see that if you've got an institution with good qualities, you might try to let it make a go of it under different circumstances.
Mm. All right. Another question? Yeah. Whoever has a microphone, speak. There we are. There. Right.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Thatcher and Thatcherism doctrine is well known and regarded in China. In fact, Thatcherism is taught in the Central Party School. How do you think Mrs. Thatcher would engage with Xi Jinping? And also, what would she think of the Belt and Road Initiative?
Hmm. Well, again, I'm afraid I have to do my spoil sport point that I don't do the what would she. But her attitude to China and her behaviour was very interesting. She went for the first time there when she was leader of the opposition, and she absolutely hated it and detested Chinese communism. She realised that she had a very difficult thing on her hands when she became prime minister, which was the future of Hong Kong. And it was a complete, almost her worst nightmare, the idea that she would have to hand back British territory to a communist dictatorship. And she behaved... She basically played a bad hand pretty boldly. Because the bad hand being, you know, if the Chinese want to invade, they could. And she actually looked into whether we could physically defend Hong Kong with troops against the Chinese and decided we couldn't. And so the question was, how do you get the most, the calmest handover? And she, the deal with Deng Xiaoping was not a bad deal, the thing, one country, two systems. First meeting she had with Deng, she was really cross with him, and she was very disgusted because he had the old Chinese habit of spitting all the time, and he had a spittoon in front of him, between them. So if you watch the film, you see Mrs. Thatcher sort of moving her legs away as he... and she really didn't like that, and she thought he was a very tough, nasty man, but she could see that he was a sane man who could think straight. And the agreement was made. She was then terrified that it would all go wrong because of the murders in Tiananmen Square, and she therefore went against her normal dislike of immigration and issued more passports to Hong Kong people to try and restore confidence in Hong Kong after that. And was always very concerned about Hong Kong people, whereas the Foreign Office tended to think of Hong Kong purely in sort of as a territorial entity and were more worried about China. And what she then did, a rather fascinating thing she did after leaving office, was that she wanted to keep in touch and support the moderates in the who had been discredited because who'd been overruled when they started killing people in Tiananmen Square. And she did a brilliant thing because one of them was sort of kept under house arrest. And so when she went to see the main thug at the time, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, I think it was Li Peng, she wanted to indicate that this poor man hadn't been forgotten. And this conversation took place in front of a whole heap of Chinese civil servants. And she deliberately planned this because she was worried he might be murdered. And so she said in public in this thing, how is he? I'd love to see him. Please, can I see him? Et cetera, et cetera. And he said, well, sort of very, very embarrassed. Well, he's very well, but I'm afraid you can't see him. And she said, oh, well, please, will you give him this present I brought? And she opened her handbag and brought out a tie and handed it over for this chap to give to the imprisoned one. Very clever thing, because the official who went with her told me that the man looked at it as if it were a cobra, because he couldn't refuse it, because that would be rude, but he couldn't possibly give it to the man either, because they were, you know, this man was considered their enemy. And so, and she did this every time she had these meetings, she'd produce a tie. and she said afterwards to the official, the reason I do this is because I think it will make it harder for them to kill him. So she kept up this great interest in it and maintained lots of contact about it. And essentially what she was trying to do was hold out for the freedom of Hong Kong, which we now see, of course, has largely fallen apart. It was sustained by the agreement for however long it was, about 20 years, I guess, and now it's in considerable, you know, it's going all the wrong way.
Another question, yes. There, or whoever has a microphone. I can't tell who has the mic. That's the trouble.
Just a quick question for Mr. Moore. Sorry. I enjoyed your first two volumes, Mr. Moore.
Thank you very much.
Looking forward to reading the third one. As a Scotsman growing up in the 70s and 80s, I've obviously got a very varied view of Mrs. Thatcher, but at least she was a politician of conviction. What do you think she would think, and I know you don't like saying this, of Mr. Johnson? Would she consider herself on the same Tory spectrum, or how would she compare herself with Mr. Johnson?
She did know Boris Johnson, but really she knew him as a journalist, and she liked his journalism very much because he was the first journalist to realise that Brussels was a story. He was a Telegraph correspondent in Brussels from, I think, 1989, and so he started to get onto all the Delors stuff, and it used to be until then a very sleepy posting for the most part in newspapers, and very dull reports. And Boris could see in these apparently dry stories the fact that there was a massive change going on in Brussels and a huge power grab by Jacques Delors, and he sort of opened that up. And Mrs. Thatcher was onto that very quickly and admired it, and she liked Boris's company. But by the time he became a political figure, she was in mental decline and wasn't very engaged in that sort of thing. Boris, I mean, you could hardly think of two more different characters, but he is loosely a Thatcherite, I would say. So he has strong beliefs in liberty, like she did, and, of course, Euroscepticism. But he's much more shall we say, flexible. So, for example, I think he believes in basic Thatcherite principles about economics, but actually the policy of his government right now is pretty much high spending, high welfare. This may be partly tactical because of the demands of Brexit and the idea of a coming election and so on. So he's not a disciple of hers, but he is an admirer. And in the sort of, if you have to the extent that a Tory has to take sides on this issue as to whether you're basically pro-Thatcher or whether you're sort of pro the Douglas Hurd, John Major, Geoffrey Howe tradition, Boris would be on the pro-Thatcher side.
Yeah. Another question? Yeah, whoever has a microphone.
I'm going to take you back to the BBC. I really enjoyed hearing about Dennis and Mrs. Thatcher. And also I enjoyed the earlier question. I'm wondering, since the BBC knows who it employs, since BBC staff are vetted keenly, and perhaps 85 or 90% of BBC employees in newsrooms would have voted Remain, how can people see themselves as journalists and not find the most striking story, their own like-mindedness and their own ostracism of the views of the majority of the country?
Well, I don't recognize the picture you paint. You're right in the sense that I agree with you, that most, I don't know this, of course, because I haven't asked them, but I assume that most BBC journalists probably did vote Remain. I voted Remain for all sorts of reasons, not least because I was born in the war and my admittedly then very childish brain, probably still very childish, thought actually it can't be a bad thing for countries to get together and so on, and that vague belief stayed with me, better to be together than to be separate, in that sense, if only in that sense. But the idea that because a journalist has a particular position on a particular subject means that that journalist is unprepared to do his or her job, is unwilling to do his or her job properly, because it gets in the way, it stands in the way of his or her own belief, is simply preposterous. And it isn't just wrong. I mean, if I were to tell you that your doctor will prescribe only those drugs that will benefit him because he happens to have shares in that particular drug company, you would say, how outrageous. That doctor is a qualified person and probably a decent person, or your lawyer, or your plumber, or whatever it happens to be. And the idea that that journalists have no ethics, no moral positions at all, is just outrageous.
No, it is, yeah. That's absolutely right, John. But I think what's very important, if you have a groupthink in an organisation, they don't understand what's coming. They don't understand the things that other people think. And so, one of the things that was very obvious to me in the whole Brexit story is that the total surprise of most BBC people...
We were all
people,
surprised, Charles.
Not very.
Everybody
no,
was
no,
surprised.
No, not very. No,
well,
not
I
very.
Disagree with that.
I knew perfectly well that at least half the country had these views. I thought that Remain would just win because
exactly.
of...
Exactly. Well, that's all I would argue as well, yes.
But honestly, I've seen it all the way through this story. I remember actually, sorry, it appears a little critical, but a long time ago now, I remember when the whole ERM business came up. I remember specifically you, John, on the Today programme, not understanding it. And I don't mean the technical side of it.
Hang on. I did an interview with John Major at the time.
Yes.
And I suggested to Major that we had gone into the ERM at a ludicrous price, as it were.
Yeah.
He responded by calling me, and the Daily Mail made a double-page spread of it. I recall it very clearly. He accused me of being an economic illiterate. And it wasn't very long after that that we were forced to withdraw from the ERM. Which, so with great respect, your recollection is, oh, I was really going to use the word the speaker likes to put on his car, but I better not
actually,
do that.
I apologise, but actually what I'm remembering is earlier, because the issue first became a public issue in 1985. And
I was only 20 then, I think.
The BBC was absolutely miles behind what it was about. That was my point. And they didn't understand or didn't want to understand the whole fundamental European argument which was embodied in it, so that it was presented as things like a personal row between Geoffrey Howe and Margaret Thatcher, which it partly was. But that's what I think John Burt, in the famous phrase, it did
bias against understanding,
because if you all talking to the same people all the time, you just don't know what other people are thinking. You don't really understand the dimensions of the problem. And I do think that's really serious. I'm not accusing the BBC of, you know, collective dishonesty, though I think some of them have been dishonest about it. I think they just don't serve the people properly because they don't understand half of them.
Michael? Now, look, we've got to finish it.
Now, yes, pretty much now, haven't we?
Yeah. Let's take one more. I'm breaking the rules in that case. One more question.
Lady there?
Over there, whatever. If you have a microphone, somebody who's got a microphone, that's the requirement.
Hi, it's me.
Oh, there we are. Right, off you go.
It's been a pleasure listening to you both tonight. And my question is twofold. So, Thatcher and Reagan put socialism to bed. Why do you think it's coming back? And what would she think of its new form, identity politics?
I think to the extent it is coming back, which is to some extent, though I notice in some ways the reaction is often more populist right-wing reactions than socialism, but to some extent it's coming back, is obviously the credit crunch and all of that. Because people always get very angry if they think that it's not, in my view, that people want equality, but they want to see that an economic system has something in it for them. And the horror of the credit crunch is that the richest, the people who largely brought this about, suffered the least, to put it crudely. And people in general suffered the most. So that's broadly true, and that's more likely to make you a socialist because you think it's to be blamed on capitalism. I think the Thatcherite argument is not to be blamed on capitalism, it's to be blamed on cartels and a failure of competition, not enough competition. That would be a classic Thatcher account of that, but I think that that would be the reason. Sorry, there was a second half to your question.
Do you know what? Forgive me if I stop.
Sorry,
you.
Speak on, John. Yeah.
Go on. You haven't got a mic? Well, look, let me stop you there, if I may, because we are a wee bit over. You're going to want to buy lots and lots of copies of Charles's book.
Yes, we must get
having taken the temperature of this meeting, about two copies of mine. At least I can't be accused of not or failing the nerve to put my at least one foot into the lion's den. And it's been a pleasure to listen
to
Charles, and it's been a pleasure to listen to even your occasionally slightly sceptical, if not cynical, questions about the BBC. Thank you all very much indeed. And books outside.
Thank you, John.